Good morning and welcome to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells.
And good morning, Lynn. Today on the program, we're going to speak first with Brian Hoffman, professor of medicine and Harvard Medical School, and the author of a new book titled Adrenaline. It's the exploration of this chemical that inspires superhuman feats and can at times be the perfect poison.
Then a conversation with Lily Copel. She's the author of a beautiful new book called The Astronauts' Wives Club. It's a true story about the group of women who bit their nails while remaining graceful as they waited for their husbands to safely return from orbit to Earth.
It's all coming up on Community Voices. It's only on KPCW, only in Park City. Stay tuned.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we make promises all the time. We just don't keep them.
Is any of the show going to air?
None. None. I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear things that none of us ever imagined saying on the radio. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9.
Nurse Pledge, how's our patient?
Dr. Drive, the patient is waking up.
The master cardiochargectomy was a huge success, and we expect a full recovery.
I feel terrific. Who knew that donating to KPCW could make me feel so good?
But the week of August 26th through 30th is critical. Make two donations and call me in the morning.
Dr. Drive, you're right. Laughter is the best medicine.
Welcome back to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Well, the cover of Brian Hoffman's new book, Adrenaline, shows a bullfighter turning towards the bull that is charging him. One can only imagine the burst of adrenaline in that bullfighter. It's the same burst that many of us in this town are not strangers to as we careen down the trails on our mountain bikes or down a ski run in the winter. Harvard Medical School professor Brian Hoffman has dug into the exploration of adrenaline. It's the fascinating molecule that drives some of our most potent experiences. Adrenaline was discovered in 1894 and quickly made its way out of the lab and into clinics around the world. Adrenaline, from its addictive qualities to its lethal qualities, and the crucial role it has played in pushing modern medicine forward. Brian Hoffman takes us on a journey, a fascinating one, through this potent fuel for our flight or fight. Welcome to Community Voices, Brian Hoffman.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Well, it's nice to have you, and wow, what a great book. And it's funny, first of all, it only needs one word as the title of it. It's just adrenaline. And it kind of tells the story, I think, about this chemical or this hormone. I don't know. What do you call it? Do you call it a hormone?
Yes, I think it is a hormone, the first one discovered. A hormone is a chemical that's released into the blood that is taken to other organs and has its effects.
So it was discovered over 100 years ago in 1894, and since then it's been, involved in 8 Nobel Prizes for discoveries throughout the last century and into this century. And maybe if we could start with sort of the simple release of adrenaline. We know when it happens. We've all felt it. So it's a common thing that we share. But how does it get released from your hormone or from your glands? Excuse me.
Yeah. So adrenaline is stored in the center of the adrenal glands, which sit on top of the kidneys. And it's stored up there. And then the brain signals the adrenal glands to release it into the blood. The brain has nerves that go to the adrenals and stimulate its release into the blood.
I guess I've always wondered, Brian, I know that we keep, we produce the hormone over and over and over, but sometimes have you ever had an experience where you're feeling so much adrenaline release that you think you must be depleting it?
Well, I think we have pretty large stores, and it's resynthesized very quickly. So we may feel depleted, but probably there's still plenty of adrenaline in our adrenal glands. However, if cells are overstimulated with adrenaline, they do have mechanisms to turn off their responsiveness.
And, Brian, you point out in the book this remarkable journey of over 150 years of the different clinicians and scientists and doctors that worked in isolation, and although they shared their results to be able to come to where we are today, it was just fascinating. And back to what you were saying about the adrenals releasing adrenaline, Addison came out and said that when the adrenals are diseased, they're not producing what the body needs. And of course, Addison's disease, as I believe it was named after him several years later, is when the patient's skin color turns darker and they have incredible fatigue and a whole bunch of other symptoms. I have a question, and that is in the book, Addison was talking about this disease and the symptoms, and then there were these other clinicians or scientists that were removing the adrenals from various animals, and nothing happened to them. So it's sort of a complex relationship in the body, isn't it?
Yes, it's very complicated. Addison did his work around 1850, and the adrenal glands had been discovered only 300 years before that. The famous Greek anatomists hadn't seen them, and they were found in Renaissance Italy. But no one had any clue as to what they did or whether they were important or not. And so Addison, as you point out, you know, was an extremely good clinician, and he noted just a few patients who had fatigue and their skin color changed, and he was the kind of physician that went into the autopsy room when his patients died. It's hard to find a doctor now that would make a house call, let alone go into the autopsy of their patients. And he found that the adrenal glands in these patients had withered away. Some people didn't believe him. Some of his patients, in reading his book, didn't actually have Addison's disease. So it was a kind of complicated thing. He didn't have any blood tests to diagnose the disease as we have now. It's much easier. And immediately after his discovery, of a very famous French neurologist, Brown Sicard, did experiments where he took out the adrenal glands from animals, and the animals died. So this seemed to confirm Addison's view that the adrenal glands were very important. But Brown Sicard didn't use modern methods to be sure that it was actually removing the adrenal glands that killed the animals, and some of his animals may have died from bleeding or from infections, which were very common in those days. So other people didn't agree with them. So it was very controversial for about 40 or 50 years whether Addison's disease was a real thing and whether the adrenals were involved. But it was very important in the discovery of adrenaline, because the doctor who did this was interested in the adrenal glands because of this controversy. The irony of the whole story is that while this led to the discovery of adrenaline, it's really other hormones in the adrenal gland that are absolutely essential for life. And this was only discovered in the early part of the 20th century. Hormones like cortisol, mm-hmm. for example, are really what keep people alive.
I wanted to ask you a quick question, Brian, about the adrenal glands. I mean, we do hear, and I think it's just sort of a saying among health care practitioners, maybe alternative healthcare practitioners more, is to say you've burnt out your adrenals. Well, as you say, it's not so possible to do that. But what is the role that cortisol, which we know is the stress hormone, how does that interact with adrenaline?
Yes, that's a very good question. Adrenaline, as we talked about, is released into the blood by the brain, and it has immediate effects. And we know this from practical experience as well as from scientific research, that your heart starts pounding almost immediately when adrenaline is released, because it activates the heart to beat faster and harder.
Mm-hmm.
Cortisol has quite different effects. While it is released in stress, most of its effects take a day or two to occur, because it alters the expression of genes in many cells in the body, and it takes time for protein levels to change in response to that. So the effects of cortisol are more slowly developing and longer lasting. Adrenaline is designed to turn on very quickly in response to stress and turn off very quickly when the stimulus is gone. So Walter Cannon at Harvard Medical School in the early part of the 20th century formulated this as a fight or flight response that our ancient ancestors in very tough environments may have to respond to a wild animal, and they would fight or run away. And adrenaline, he conceived of the idea, integrates the organs in our body to best prepare us to do that by helping us pump lots of blood to our muscles, to help us get oxygen in and out of our lungs, to mm-hmm. providing fuel from the liver and fat cells to feed our muscles as they exercise. So it's really designed to go on and off quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
one of the concerns is that in our more modern era, many of the threats that turn on our adrenaline are more symbolic. Stress at work, dealing with traffic, that doesn't lead to a physical exertion, and this may have adverse health consequences in a system that really wasn't designed for our modern world.
And popular culture has really jumped on this fast responsiveness of adrenaline. I'm thinking about Pulp Fiction, the movie, where John Travolta playing Vincent and Uma Thurman playing Mia, she has some sort of overdose, and he takes this syringe with adrenaline and just jams it into her breastbone. She pops up like there's nothing wrong, and they go about their business.
Continue dancing.
They continue dancing.
Yes, no, that's certainly true. And Mission Impossible 3, I think there's a similar type of scene. And it's fascinating that some of the earliest references to adrenaline in newspapers, going back to the turn of the 20th century, so around 1901, involved adrenaline use in patients that had died. And adrenaline is still used to this very day as part of cardiac resuscitation. But a simple injection of adrenaline by itself will not restart a heart that stopped. But this got into the newspapers because of some genuine research work around 1905. For example, a physician at the Cleveland Clinic publicized this quite a bit, and he ended up getting letters from people, for example, from a woman whose husband had been buried in a glacier and wondering if he could be thawed out and brought back to life with adrenaline. So it was very notorious as a great wonder drug through the early part of the 20th century, things that were greatly exaggerated. And just as many new drugs today are greatly exaggerated in the popular press. So people need to be wary about what they read, that some very good drugs end up being viewed with too much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I assume that things didn't work out too well for the glacier guy.
I don't think he was taken on at the Cleveland Clinic. Perhaps he didn't have the right health insurance.
Right.
Probably so. So, Brian, I want to get into the whole, you know, addiction to adrenaline, the adrenaline junkie persona. We, of course, living in a mountain town, see our share of these sorts of folks, and I'm sure we fall prey to it. At least I know I do. However, I, you know, you look at the base jumping and the slack lines that go over a, you know, 500 foot drop. You look at, you know, someone like Nick Walenda and his tight rope walking over the Grand Canyon. And even I think the most extreme for me is the squirrel suits that people wear, and they sort of fly around the mountains. And it just, it seems like it's not stopping. And I'm wondering if people build up some sort of immunity to adrenaline, and then they have to push it further and further to get that feeling. And why do we want that feeling?
Yeah, so that's a really fascinating question, which I address in the last chapter of my book called Adrenaline Junkies. And I had my background as a scientist interested in the molecular mechanisms by how adrenaline activates cells. So I had to learn quite a bit to try to address this question. And the first problem is, does adrenaline actually, after it's released in the blood, influence the brain to experience the feeling of excitement that you're talking about? Or do we get excited and then simply secrete the adrenaline to make our muscles work better? And it's a very complicated question. It's pretty well established that adrenaline doesn't get into the brain from the blood. The brain has a barrier called the blood-brain barrier that keeps many chemicals out of the brain. And adrenaline probably doesn't get into the brain. So my first view of this, which was Walter Cannon's view 100 years ago, is that the brain causes adrenaline to be secreted, but the emotions are purely in the brain itself. But more recent work over the past 20 years has suggested that changes in the body can influence how the brain perceives emotions. It's a very difficult thing to study, but I think we will learn much more about whether adrenaline's effect on other chemicals in the body or nerve stimuli that come back from, say, a hard-beating heart back into the brain might influence our emotions.
Our guest is Brian Hoffman. He's the author of the new book, Adrenaline.
And as Lynn mentioned, there's certainly no shortage of adrenaline junkies in Park City. One of our residents here is Jeff Tabin, who holds a number of distinctions, including when he was a student at Oxford University, he joined the legendary Dangerous Sports Club in London. And on April 1st, 79, they put on tuxedos and they drank a ton of champagne. And he and his comrades were the first bungee jumpers as they jumped off the Clifton Suspension Bridge in Bristol, England. In preparation for this morning's conversation, I spoke to Jeff last night, and he said a couple of things, because he's climbed Everest a bunch of times and he's done a number of things. He said everything is more alive and heightened when he's on adrenaline, and that's something that that's a feeling that he wants to reproduce, that he wants to bring back again. And the second thing he said was that adrenaline actually kicked in a few minutes before the jump, that first bungee jump. So it was the anticipation, and I think that was part of the excitement. Back to an earlier question from Lynn, why do people continue to go after this feeling? Is it a form of self-medication?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that we have a range of characters in our population, and perhaps that served a great evolutionary benefit, that having people that were bold, that felt really good taking risks. We wouldn't want everybody to be that way, and that there are some people that prefer more sedate activities, and it's quite possible there's a genetic basis for this, but there definitely are, as you describe, people who are absolutely drawn to that, whereas myself, for example, I've been to Park City, but that's been to go fly fishing, which is a much more relaxed kind of thing, and I wouldn't dream of jumping off a mountain with a parachute or anything like that. So I think there are differences. I mean, there are differences in the amount of anesthetic that people require to be put to sleep for surgery. Mm-hmm. So I think the brain works differently, and some people identify an excitement that is also associated with adrenaline secretion, and they want to keep going back to it.
Right. It makes me wonder, Brian, if, you know, as you said before, it's the emotion that we experience in our brain that doesn't really have anything to do with the actual chemical response, the physiological chemical response. It's just how we experience our own emotion as it relates to an adrenaline secretion, I guess.
Yes, I think that's true. But I think there is the possibility that the way our body responds, it does feed back in some way to our brain.
Right.
So it's they're probably tied together in some way, and I think future research will help elucidate that.
Okay. Brian, I wanted to ask you a question. I was absolutely fascinated with the process over so many years that the different doctors, scientists, and clinicians as they worked in isolation, but at the same time they shared their information with other people. And if you think that the scientific process is orderly, predictable, or simple, I mean, it was everything but that, because somebody would run into a dead end, and somebody would take that dead end and, you know, find something else with it, and how all of this worked. And these scientists were around the world. They were in France and in this country, and I mean, just everywhere, and somehow they got to these conclusions. Can you talk about the scientific process?
Yes, John, thank you for asking that, because that was one of my main purposes in writing the book, was to, by using adrenaline and the extraordinary research that's happened over the past 100 years, illustrate to people who are not necessarily scientists themselves, how dynamic and exciting scientific research is. And it's not something where you just, work hard and grind away and you get new facts. There's enormous creativity, luck, circumstances, taste in scientific problems. It can lead to joyous and wonderful outcomes that are beautiful in their own right, but also have led to the discovery of new drugs that mimic adrenaline or block its effects, that have had revolutionary impact on treatment of asthma, cardiovascular disease, and so on. So I thought adrenaline, the story, as you mentioned, over the last 100 years, with multiple Nobel Prize discoveries coming from trying to understand what adrenaline does and how it does it in cells and in individual molecules, gives people a chance to see that science is not boring. It's really can be very exciting, and human foibles, determination, capacity to bounce back from failure are what goes on in laboratories around the world.
Yes, and last week on our show, we met with the director of the Nano Institute, Mark Porter, from the University of Utah, and he talked about how they took different disciplines, they huddled these people together from chemistry, physics, material science, computer science, nursing, medical science, and in this collaborative environment so that all these different disciplines were working together. Hearing about that at the Nano Institute and hearing about that type of collaborative effort in other studies, I mean, it couldn't be more exciting for the future as far as what we're going to be able to do as we learn to share information and as we learn to work with other disciplines outside of our discipline.
Yes, John, I agree completely. And one of the other things I tried to illustrate in the book was that many of these people who made great discoveries, including Nobel prizes were, in some sense, ordinary people. Very few of them were child prodigies. Many of them went to small colleges and universities, and through their personal characteristics and being in the right place, did some wonderful things so that scientific opportunities are open to a range of people, both in terms of their special interests, as you describe, and also their individual capabilities, that they don't have to be able to solve differential equations in their head to make important contributions to biomedical research.
Right. The book is Adrenaline, and our guest is Brian Hoffman. And Brian, I want to thank you, first of all, for making this interview and the things that you say about adrenaline and all this, you know, pretty complicated science, making it accessible for us. And John and I aren't scientists, but we sure do love to talk about it. And again, it's great to bring science down to the layperson. So thank you for that. And I have one final question that I've just been sitting here. It's been nagging at me. Why hasn't, I mean, adrenaline's been synthesized and extracted and put in, you know, used in a variety of applications. Why have people never used it as a recreational drug if people are seeking that adrenaline feeling?
Yes, excellent. There are adrenaline-like drugs that sadly are used recreationally, like amphetamines and cocaine.
Okay.
But adrenaline, if you just inject that into a person, they don't really feel excitement. And that's probably because it doesn't get into the brain directly. So they'll feel as if they're excited, but it doesn't, fortunately, it doesn't really do things on their own in somebody just sitting in their living room.
Okay, because, wow, you could really do a number on your body on really burning it out if you did do that. So, okay, well, that's a great answer. Thank you. And, Brian, thanks so much for your time today, and thanks for joining us on Community Voices.
Well, I'd like to thank you and John for having me as a guest. I've enjoyed it enormously. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Best of luck to you.
And that, again, was Brian Hoffman, the author of Adrenaline. Boy, I like that book. And here is this week's rendition of Park City History Bits. We'll be back after these words and the History Bits with our next guest, Lily Copel. She is the best-selling author of the book, The Red Leather Diary, and now she's come out with the book about the astronauts' wives, The Club. Stay with us.
Do you think Park City would be as popular as it is today if it still took 4 hours to get here? This is Bill Redeker with your weekly Park City History Bit. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, horse-drawn stagecoaches were frequently running up and down the canyon between Salt Lake City and Park City. Stagecoaches got their name from the different stages the drivers stopped at to change out tired horses. The 4-hour trip through the canyon required 4 stops. The driver and a second person sat in the front of the stagecoach. The second person carried a shotgun and was responsible for defending the coach from snakes, wild animals, and robbers. Next time you call shotgun when getting into a car, you'll know where the term came from. One of Park City's stagecoaches is on display at the Park City Museum. Retired in 1935, it sat in the garage of what is now known as the Kimball Art Center until the Kimball family donated it in 1989. It took 2 years and more than $18,000 to clean and restore.
This Park City History Bit is brought to you by the Park City Museum, where you can explore Park City history every day on Main Street. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub every evening starting at 3 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information. You must be 21 years or older to enter.
Hello, this is Eric Clark, General Manager at Zermatt Resort and Spa. Proud supporters of KPCW, the Spa at Zermatt offers services inspired by the classical European spa experience, including body treatments, facials, nail services, and massage. Open daily at Zermatt Resort in Midway, 435-709-9596 or ZermattResort.com.
And welcome back to Community Voices. I'm John Wells with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. In 1959, when the seven Mercury astronauts were announced, I was 7 years old, living in New York. 6 months earlier, my birthday, my father gave me Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, at the time, two separate magazine subscriptions. They're, I think, bundled together now. And I read those things and wore those magazines out, and I knew many of the names of our top test pilots and their accomplishments. And this would begin for me a 10-year extraordinary fascination with the Mercury program, Gemini, and Apollo programs that culminated with the landing on the moon on July 20th, 1969. And during this period, myself and many other people around the country knew everything about the astronauts. Well, everything that Life magazine wanted to tell us, and or maybe Tom Wolfe and his books. But knew everything about the astronauts. We didn't know very much about the astronauts' wives. And our next guest, Lily Copel, is a best-selling author of the book Red Leather Diaries and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine, The Daily Beast, and The Huffington Post, and Glamour Magazine. And what could be more glamorous than a group of women who were transformed from military spouses into American royalty as their husbands were propelled into orbit? And literally, this is the true story of the Astronaut Wives Club. The book is, well, that's the book. It looks at the missions of the astronauts from the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program, ultimately landing a man on the moon. And it's the story of the women who stayed at home with the kids, biting their nails while supporting their husbands and each other and remaining graceful as they did it. We'd like to welcome Lily Copel to the show. Lily, good morning.
Good morning.
Fascinating book.
Thank you so much. Well, I found these women absolutely extraordinary and was just very surprised when I stumbled upon their story that it hadn't been told in, you know, over 50 years. And I just felt that it was really important to focus on this slice of sort of forgotten American history.
And that was actually going to be my first question. Why did it take so long for this story to be told?
Well, it's funny. I came up with the idea one Saturday when I was sitting at home in New York, and I was sort of procrastinating on a novel I was working on and looking at this large photo book and looking at pictures that are familiar to all of us, Neil Armstrong planting the American flag in the lunar surface, Buzz Aldrin in his, you know, big marshmallow spacesuit. And then I turned a page and saw this picture of the Astro Wives, as I learned they were called at the time. And they were wearing these sort of poochy mini dresses and had these skyrocketing beehives. And you know, I was on a big Mad Men kick at the time. And I turned to my husband, who's a huge fan of the Wright stuff in Apollo 13, and I just said, has anything ever been written about the astronaut wives? And his eyes sort of widened. And he said, you know, I don't think so. We've heard of bits and pieces of them, but not their full story. And I sort of hit the ground running from there and started calling these women and learning that they had been in the Astronaut Wives Club, an actual sort of space sister sorority since the mid-60s, that they still get together for cruises and reunions. And when I started sitting down with them, Joe Shura, Wally Shura's wife, was one of the first women I interviewed. And I said to her, you know, with Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer walking through your homes, how is it possible that the wives' story was never told before? And she looked at me and she said, we'd go hide. but, you know, they were very protective of the program and of their astronaut husbands. And as you mentioned, you know, Life magazine really, well, they did a great job reporting. They really portrayed this sort of perfect picture-perfect image of the 1950s and 60s housewife while profiling the astronaut wives. And so they were a little scared to let the full story come out. But I think at this point in their lives, they're all older, and they felt that, you know, it really was important to get their story on record.
And Life magazine, their first betrayal of the astronauts' wives of the original Mercury program, they, they really cleaned them up. I mean, they airbrushed them. They took out the wrinkles. All the girls decided to wear pink lipstick, but somebody on Madison Avenue said, no, red's the way to go. And they actually changed the color of their lipstick. And you said something that I got a kick out of, and that was that if you take the three programs, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, you said that Doris Day look was Mercury, that it was mod for Gemini, and it was suburban psychedelic for Apollo. And I like that.
Yeah, well, you know, you look at these old life photographs, and to me, the astronaut wives were really like our first reality stars, America's first reality stars, because Life magazine buys the rights to exclusive coverage for the astronauts and their families starting in 1959. So you literally have reporters and photographers embedded in these women's homes. And, you know, they were military wives. They were not used to being in the limelight. These are not like your Kardashians who want to be in the spotlight necessarily. But that's just part of the job of keeping it cool, calm, and collected while your husband's going into space. So, you do see this incredible just array of what it meant to be a stay-at-home mom, a suburban mom, but in the space burbs, as they were called, outside of NASA's operations in Houston, through the coverage of the astronaut wives and their children.
Lily, it's funny, women now, you know, we have on so many hats and we have to do it all. Certainly these wives, the astronauts' wives, had to kind of do it all because, as you say, they were housewives. They had to stay home and raise the kids. Someone had to raise the kids. Well, you know, the other part of the partnership was off in space.
And, absolutely.
And yet they had to be, as you said, almost like royalty, having tea with Jackie Kennedy, being part of this Houston socialite club. And I suppose that different wives handled it differently.
Right. You know, we think of the woman who does it all now as sort of like a post-feminist development. It's like having the career and being a mother. These women, although they were stay-at-home moms, and when I talked to one of them at first, Reen Carpenter, who is the wife of Scott Carpenter, second American to orbit the Earth, and she was blonde and beautiful. She almost looks like the space-age answer to Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. JFK once said he found her the most attractive of the astronaut wives. I said to her, you know, you were like, you know, because she would go on to host a feminist television show, and I suggested to her that she was perhaps a pioneering feminist among the wives, and she was like, you know, really remember that in the beginning we were career military wives. She said our eyes were glued on our husbands' careers. We were entertaining machines. But to go back to that point of doing it all, they had to appear as the perfect housewife and pretend that they didn't, you know, they weren't scared at all when their husband was riding on what was essentially the world's largest stick of dynamite. So that's what I found so fascinating about the astronaut wives, that they really were sort of what we would call super moms today.
Right. Now, going back to 1959, I mean, were there, when those first astronauts with the Mercury program, when they were announced, were there any wives that said, no way, you can't do this, I'm not going to support you? Or were they all on board? I mean, I would be, you know, I would be very terrified.
Absolutely. Annie Glenn, for example, had some real concerns, and hers was that she and John were religious, and she didn't know whether a man going into, you know, God's heavens for the first time, she didn't know what sort of the ethical and moral and spiritual considerations were around that, and she went to speak to the family's minister, and, you know, he assured her that, you know, John exploring up there, you know, was no conflict. But, you know, each of the women came into the program you know, with a different feeling about it and with different anxieties and different senses of excitement. For example, Trudy Cooper, who is married to Gordo Cooper, she was very adventurous and bold. She was an aviatrix herself. In fact, she and Gordo had been separated before he was picked as an astronaut, but one of the first prerequisites for becoming an astronaut was basically you had to have a happy little wife and marriage at home, and Trudy and Gordo actually got back together for the sake of the space race. So that's how gung-ho she was about Gordo exploring space. Then you have someone like Rene Carpenter, who, you know, not only was excited about the prospect of Scott exploring space, but she really brought, in terms of to the whole public relations angle, a great deal of flair because she had wanted to be an actress and a writer. And so half of the program during the Cold War was not only getting men into space, but sort of beaming this perfect American family image to the world. And so she was a real pro at that and would even coach the other wives about how to deal with the press.
And when Russia actually beat us by putting the first man up, Yuri, to circle the Earth in a capsule, I think it was Nixon that came back and said, you may have gotten the first guy up into orbit, but we are building this beautiful middle class, and it's driven, well, I think he implied that it was driven by the astronauts' wives and their husbands and people like them. And I just want to mention that as you weave the stories through the period that covers the Mercury, the Gemini, and the Apollo programs, it's fascinating. There are a lot of funny stories, but it's also a sad story. There was a lot of loss. And as I think about all the stories, Pat White possibly has the saddest story, where her husband, Ed, who was a top-notch test pilot and then was brought in for the program, he was slated to be the first man to go to the moon, along with Gus Grissom, right? And I'm thinking Betty Grissom, right? Gus Grissom, and you know, ended up in that tragic fire where the three of them were killed, and she never got over that, and she eventually committed suicide.
Yeah, it's a very sad story. You know, part of the unusual aspect of the astronaut wives' story is just this sort of bubble world that they lived in. All of the astronauts and their families lived in the space burbs, as I mentioned, around NASA's operations in Houston. Togethersville was the name journalists gave it because it was such a tight-knit community. It was almost like a little swath of Jetson suburbia, you know, and it was a really happening place in the 60s. And the families banded together for good and for the bad. And you know, one of the things, you know, many don't realize perhaps is that eight men were lost on the path to the moon, eight astronauts, three in the Apollo 1 fire, as you mentioned, was really NASA's first large-scale tragedy when three astronauts, you know, died in a flash fire in the Apollo 1 capsule. And it really hit home very, very hard for their wives. In the beginning with NASA, since they were a civilian space agency and still figuring out their role, they didn't have a protocol in place. And when the first astronaut died, Ted Freeman, in a T-38 crash, his wife was actually informed when a journalist rang her doorbell. It was Halloween 1964, and he wanted to know her reaction to the accident. And she, you know, she said, "What accident?" And that's how she learned her husband had died. And so after that, NASA got together with the wives, and they instituted a protocol, which was when any man was lost, all of his wife's friends were called to go to the widow's home and would sit with her until a man or an official from NASA could notify the family. So that's what happened with Apollo 1, and it happened for Betty Grissom and Martha Chaffee and Pat White. And I think you see in the astronaut's story, and this is why I feel it's a redemptive one, most of the women, especially if they lost a husband, were suddenly forced to realize, wow, I can't just base my identity around my husband, you know, the hero's wife. I really have to stake territory on my own for, you know, myself and my family and the other wives around that woman would also get hip to this. Well, what if something happens to my astronaut? I better really build a life for myself, not just as his wife. So it's that starting of sort of like the women's lib movement mm-hmm. reaching the distant shores of Togethersville, which was a more conventional neighborhood. But Pat White sadly never got over Ed White's death. And while the astronaut wives were planning a reunion many years later, she committed suicide just before they were going to meet the women. And they really viewed Pat's death as sort of the final victim of Apollo 1.
Mm, yeah, and again, like you say, a signal to them to establish their own identities. But again, yet another hat that they had to wear is establishing their own identities. And I'm wondering, Lily, if the Togethersville, as you call it, or as they called it, what happened when one of the husbands was lost? Were you kept in that area? I mean, obviously you had to go out and start a new life. Did they still live there?
It was not easy for many of the space widows, you know, and, you know, there was the feeling, as there often is on a military base, that a widow hanging around was sort of not good for morale. So it was basically, you know, get things together and, you know, pack up as soon as possible. Some of the wives stayed around and established new lives for themselves in and around Houston, but many of them really felt the environment to be stifling, and they felt sort of persona non grata. One of the wives, Jeannie Bassett, moved her family to San Francisco. Her feeling was that she didn't want to be a third wheel. So, you know, this is a time in these women's lives that, for all of its exhilarating highs and lows, they really are mankind's highest highs and lowest lows. It's defined who they are. Before Jeannie left for San Francisco, though, the Astronaut Wives Club, which was, the group of wives who got together for tea and cocktails and deviled eggs and all of the things, you know, women did, smoking cigarettes and drinking Sanka back in the 1960s, they gave her a gift of a little golden whistle, and that was the wives' motto. And the motto was, whistle and we'll be there. And many of the astronaut wives wear that charm to this day.
And the wives, of course, were busy in Houston raising their families and trying to keep things together. Their husbands were flying all over the place, but they spent a lot of time in Cocoa Beach outside of Cape Canaveral. And there was the entire environment, which was totally different out there, including cookies. And if you could talk about cookies.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the men, once you're named as an astronaut, you might as well have been given a Superman cape, you know. They were rock stars, and they were followed around like the Beatles. And in Cocoa Beach, where the guys were training at Cape Canaveral, later Cape Kennedy, during the week, flying home to Houston only on the weekends, they had astronaut groupies, to the horror, of course, of the wives. And these groupies had a name, and they were known as Cape Cookies. So, you know, back in the day, we're talking about this sort of Mad Men-esque world, the astronauts had their sort of playground at the Cape and at Cocoa Beach with the Cape Cookies, and the wives were in their sort of bubble world of Togethersville back in Houston, and NASA hoped that these two worlds would never cross. Of course, that becomes impossible by the end of the book and towards the late 60s, though no divorce was really allowed within NASA until it erupts in what's reported as the first space divorce in tabloids around the world, when Don and Harriet Isley get divorced. And Don did leave his wife in a pretty terrible situation for a cookie.
And in the beginning, in 59 and 60 and 61, anytime words would come out of an astronaut's mouth, NASA would be, you know, there to counsel that astronaut on, well, I wouldn't say this and I would say that a little bit differently. But then as time went on, I mean, Deke Slayton, who was in charge of the astronaut corps, all of these guys reported to him, and he actually condoned the whole cookie thing and said, hey, listen, just keep your lives separate and basically enjoy yourselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, the guys were training quite a bit, and there was still a culture of, like, work hard, play hard, and make sure a reporter from the National Enquirer doesn't follow you back to the Holiday Inn in Cocoa Beach where all the astronauts were given dollar-a-room nights. So many of the space couples and the space marriages didn't survive the moon because the wives were really hoping for their husband to come back and finally be the family man who it hadn't been possible for him to be as the big superhero. So sadly, many of the marriages fell apart, but many of them have stuck together. Marilyn Lovell and Jim Lovell, who is played by Tom Hanks in Apollo 13, have become great friends through the writing of this book, and they're really a couple that has the right stuff. They met in high school and were sweethearts, and they just celebrated their 61st wedding anniversary.
Oh, that's nice. I was going to ask you, Lily, the average age of these wives now.
They're in their 70s and 80s for the most part. Some of the Mercury wives are in their 90s as well. Wow. But they're a very dynamic group. Two of the wives who have been best friends since they lived in the space burbs in the 60s, Barbara Butler Cernan and Sue Bean, they just took a road trip this summer to visit another astronaut wife that lives out in New Mexico and were shooting me photos, you know, via Facebook the whole way along. And we had a huge launch party this summer in Houston, you know, pun intended, launch party.
Yeah.
And it was pretty neat because Gene Cernan, who, of course, was the last man to walk on the moon in 1972, sort of wrangled the microphone from me and told this beautiful group of women in a room filled with about 200 people just that if it weren't for the wives and the support they gave the astronauts back on Earth, we would have never landed on the moon.
Oh. Lily Copel, best-selling author who has written a fascinating book, The Astronaut Wives Club, A True Story. And Lily, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning. It's really a good book.
Wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye now. And you've been listening to Community Voices here on KPCW, only in Park City, of course, only on KPCW. And wow, was that an interesting book. I can't wait to send it to my mom because I know, although we're sort of similarly aged, John, I was a little younger than you and I didn't live through that time exactly. I know my mom probably followed these women.
It was such a special time for this country and that 10-year period for those three programs. It was, it certainly doesn't have the cachet that it did back then. Today.
Right. Shall we thank our underwriters?
I think we should. 350 Main, the Spur Bar and Grill, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and San Francisco Design.
And thanks for listening to Community Voices. You're listening to KPCW. It's your public community radio only in Park City. It's 91.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's the happening.
Summer's here!
Shh! Summer's where? Wait, Jan, it's here? Uh-oh. Don't tell anybody about Park City's summer secrets.
It's a secret? But John, isn't that our job, telling Park City who's got savory summer snacks and where the sizzle and fun is?
Secrets out for summer. Find out what all the cool kids are up to this summer. Tune in to Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by the Summit County Fair.
All Seasons Adventures.
Park Silly Sunday Market.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
And the Homestead Resort. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional, FHA, and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And we'll head now into National Public Radio news from Washington. It's Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with John Wells. Thanks for listening.